It's Tuesday, March the 16th, 2021. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Well, good afternoon and happy spring break, everyone. We are in the middle of our spring break here in central Oklahoma. We have been back face-to-face at school since August the 14th with just a few different interruptions for remote learning. And a couple weeks ago, I had an opportunity to have a remote conversation that I am very excited to bring to you. I had a chance to interview author Claude Larson about her new book, which also has a companion workbook, The Power of Choice, A Teen's Guide to Finding Personal Success. And the way that I would like to situate this conversation is by pointing out how much the pandemic and teaching during the pandemic, both last spring and what I like to call our time of emergency remote learning when we were completely remote, and then this school year, which has been a blend for us with a number of students who have been on either what we call short-term flex or long-term flex learning at home, it has been a time where the importance of connecting with students, building relationship, and taking time for classroom community has been more apparent to me than ever. These are things that have always been important, but during the pandemic, it's become, you know, particularly visible to me. And so what Claude Larson has done in this book is really taken a series of conversations that she originally had with her eighth grade science students and put them in a format that any of us as classroom teachers can use for the building of classroom community. These are designed to be short conversations that you have with students and conversations that really touch on things that are so important in not just school and academia, but in life. And it can really open up the door to some great conversations. And so, since we had this conversation back in February, Claude has also published a workbook version of her book. It's called A Companion Journal. That is just available as a paperback, but her book is available either in paperback or in Kindle edition. And I really, really think this is just a practical, useful guide that we can use just exactly as she has packaged and chunked these conversations. This can be used by students individually to respond, and so they can use this as their own response journal, but it's going to have a lot of different applicability to you. And so I know a lot of the folks who follow me on social media, whether you're new to the podcast or you've been listening for a while, this podcast has been going since 2005, which is a little hard to believe. But whatever the case may be, many, many of you, like me, are educators and classroom teachers, and we have these opportunities to have conversations with students. And these kinds of tools, like Claude has provided in her book, are exactly the kind of thing that we look for when we are deciding how are we going to be, you know, designing our learning, our lessons, our interactions with students, whether that is face-to-face or it's online or it's a blend of each one. So without further ado, let's turn back the clock to February the 22nd, I think it was, 2021, when I had a chance to have a Zoom call with Claude Larson talking about her book and project, The Power of Choice, A Teen's Guide to Finding Personal Success. Well, hello, everyone. Today is February the 22nd, 2021, and this is Wes Fryer with Claude Larson, and we are here to talk about her book, The Power of Choice, A Teen's Guide to Finding Personal Success. So, Claude, let's start a little with your background. What have you done, and where have you worked in the past that led you to write The Power of Choice?
Well, I was a career educator. So I started teaching in 1986, and very different world back then, right? Pre-internet and, you know, computers in the classroom kind of thing. And I, you know, through the years, every year there's like a new challenge, and anybody who has kids or is a teacher, you know this, right? Like, suddenly it's the fidget spinners are all the rage. And then the next year there's always like a new thing. But, I got to the point really in my last few years of teaching where the new challenges were becoming really hard to overcome, especially because I was teaching eighth graders. So essentially 14-year-olds, and the challenges went from, you know, they're distracted by events or things to like they're vaping in the bathroom, you know, mm-hmm. and I became really concerned about their future. Not that I wasn't always, but in 1986, the things that they were getting involved in were like kind of the, like kid stuff, right? And then it got to be really serious. So, you know, I looked at that and I was watching just like the deterioration of like their work ethic, their ability to focus, their attention span, things that were of true value that was lacking. And, it made them have a really hard time in school, and it made me have a really hard time trying to educate them. And so this was a total experiment. I sat at my desk one day on a Friday. For whatever reason, I had finished everything I had to do, which teachers know, you're never done. You just have to stop at some point.
Right.
And the desk is clear. I'm looking out the window of my classroom and I'm like, I am not affecting any change. Now, when you're a teacher, that's tough, right? Mm-hmm. 'Cause you think, all right, you never lose that ideology that like I'm coming in and I'm helping the world be a better place, right? 'Cause kids are going to learn and they're going to grow up and be adults. And I was like, man, I'm not getting through.
Wow.
And so that was really hard because, you know, it had been coming for a while, and I came to this revelation that they're not going to change. And if I keep doing the same thing, this is not going to improve. So I, you know, took stock in that idea over the weekend. I said, what are the things that are missing that I really need them to work on? And I decided, I wrote 10 little mini lessons. When I tell you, like, the whole outline could fit on a sticky note, super short, main ideas. These are, you know, they need to know how attitude plays into, you know, their life. They need to know what excellence is, right? They need to have certain thoughts that they just aren't getting anywhere. And I said to myself, this is a big risk because I could fall flat on my face talking to a bunch of 14-year-olds about their attitude, right? And I said, well, here's the reality. I could fall on my face and then they can graduate and go on to high school in a few months and everybody will forget about this. Or I can try to impact the kids and affect some change. So it really just started as an experiment out of my own observations and my own frustrations. And I tell you, in one mini lesson, because I wasn't going to do this in bulk, I said, okay, it's going to be a little bit. I'm only going to do it on Monday. I'm only going to take a little bit of time. In one Monday with my five classes, I saw a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just amazing, right? So, you know, the next week when Monday came, there it was on there, you know, and I always had like sort of a catchy title, right? Like the first lesson I did, I titled it Your Dirty Mind.
Yeah, right. That definitely catches kids' attention and adults too.
Attention, right?
That's right.
You know, we weren't going to talk about sex, but, you know, they all got the point by the end,
right,
is what happened. So, because, you know, when you're around teenagers for that long, you really understand what motivates them, what doesn't motivate them. And you get to know, you know, their language, which changes year to year. But I, you know, I tried this. The class went on to graduate. The next year I said, man, I'm going to start this earlier in the year. And I did it for the entire year. And on a holiday weekend, I want to say, like, you know, Columbus Day or Martin Luther King Day or whatever, you know, whatever that Monday off was, there was no lesson because there wasn't a Monday. So Tuesday rolled around and they were like, so are we doing Mindful Monday? And I said, well, it's not Monday. And they, it was like, oh no, no, like we got to do this. Like we have to start our week like this. At which point I knew this was catching on, right? Cause now we're in the year. I've done this maybe four or five times. And somewhere right around that time, I said, holy cow, like this is working. They're listening and they're actually more productive. They're more engaged. They're more polite. They're nicer to each other. Like this is great. Yeah. I got to write a book because if this can help me, like this
can help, everyone,
this can help a lot of kids, right? And this can help a lot of teachers who were, and I know I wasn't alone. I wasn't the only one feeling like, what am I doing here? You know, like, why am I getting out of bed at 4:30 every morning and coming here?
Right.
Like, what, you know, like,
Sure. So, well, that's kind of a partial answer, or at least a segue into my next question. Which really is around personal success. So your book is titled A Teen's Guide to Finding Personal Success. So how do you define personal success in the context of the book and your work? And do you think that's different, if at all, for teenagers versus adults?
Okay, so personal success. And I will say the beauty of the book is I never define personal success.
Okay.
Never, because it's like maybe you want to be an artist and for you, personal success would be like if I could have my work hanging in a museum, I would be a success. Or you want to be a soldier, right? And if I could lead a platoon to, you know, successfully carry out a mission, that would be my success. Maybe I want to be a CEO. Maybe I want to be rich and I'm going to find a way to have lots of money. And that's how you're going to define your personal success. So I don't define it for you because my personal success, personal to me, it's not, you know, has nothing to do with what anybody else wants. You know,
it's kind of like self-actualization. It's identifying what your purpose and what your desire is. How are you going to find fulfillment and, you know, self-actualization. I mean, you're going to realize your dreams, basically.
Exactly right. And it's funny because, like, on my personal success list was not writing a book. That sort of came. My personal success was, like, I want to help kids be better and go out in the world in a million directions and make it a better place, right? So not because they were all going to become physicists, because that's what I was teaching at the time, but because they're going to be better people, right? They're going to be better educated,
right.
Like whatever that was. So my goal as an educator was very like driven by I am advancing, you know, the future. As a parent, it was like, I want my kids to be, you know, productive adults who are responsible and self-reliant, right? And that I'm a successful parent because both of my adult children certainly meet those things. And, you know, I'm an artist. So like, what is my goal? I wanted to be a part of a gallery. Now I am part of a gallery. So like, I have a different personal success and it's changed over the years, you know, cause I think when you're a young parent, you just want to be a good parent.
Sometimes you want to survive, you know, it depends.
During COVID, you just want to be
like
able to get through the day. You know, you can't even look at the whole week kind of thing, right?
Yep, it changes. Yeah, it does.
And I think for teens, you know, again, it's different for them because some really do want like fame, right? And they want to be and they want the spotlight, right? And some kids are like, oh, that's so not me.
But it sounds like a big part of this was trying to have kids thinking about goals and their aspirations and then how that might shape their behavior today. Is that fair? That's part of the thought process you wanted to help encourage them to get into?
Yes, that's exactly right. And a lot of times they would, you know, they'd make a statement, like they'd want something. And I'd say, well, why do you want that? What is it about that thing that you want? And when they really sat and thought about it, it was really like because everybody else has it. Or, you know, like I said, if you could have anything, right, only one thing, what would it be? Would it be that? But why? And like when you make them stop and explain to you why they want it, sometimes it's just a long enough self-reflection that they start to realize, maybe I don't want that. You know, maybe I really want something else, which is, I mean, that's great, right? That's the point. That's the beauty of humanity, right? We all want things.
Well, it becomes metacognitive at that point, maybe. They're thinking about their own thinking a little more, and then that might cause them to think differently because they've examined it in a different way or more closely.
Oh, yeah. And they don't take the time to examine it. I think that's part of the overscheduling of lives, you know?
Yeah.
You go from school to this activity to that activity.
That's also kind of a partial answer perhaps to this next question, which is about sort of biggest obstacles today and how things are different. So if you think about the mid to late 80s, you know, what do you think would be the biggest obstacles for teens now in being able to figure out what they want to do in life and finding that personal success? And how have you seen that maybe change over your arc of being, you know, both a parent and a teacher?
Sure. I think that today's biggest obstacle for kids being successful is comparison. Because when you were in school, when I was in school, right, you compared yourself to maybe the other kids in the class. This kid's better at math than me. That kid's better at basketball than me, which would be the entire class because I was the worst at basketball. But, you know, like you had this very small pool of people for comparison. And now it's like I follow 2,000 people on Instagram and they're all doing more amazing things than me, right? And it's easier to feel a lot smaller, right? And it's a lot easier to lose your perspective on what your value is if you're comparing yourself, because that would just kill your motivation to do anything creative or to try anything new.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
If somebody else can do it better, why bother? Yeah, but you can do it the way you're going to do it.
Well, and right? something that I heard a few years ago from an academic who's an anthropologist on identity was he was saying that really our identity is so much formed by what's reflected back to us. It's not just what we choose to project out. So it really matters what we have around us, those messages, those images. He did his graduate work in Papua New Guinea and has great stories, but one of them is about just pretty much losing himself because there were no cultural markers that he was familiar with that helped validate who he believed he was. And I mean, when I heard that, I just thought that is hugely impactful, and what you're saying makes a lot of sense when we think about Instagram or Snapchat and just it's just this much bigger pool, and that's got to have huge impacts on kids when not only is it larger in size and scope, but just the ways in which people really curate their identities. We talk about that in different ways, but you know, you're not seeing quote unquote reality through your cell phone. You know, you'd be seeing more of that if the person was just coming to school and they hadn't, you know, done their hair or whatever. I don't know. It just, you're seeing less of reality than ever before.
That's true. Cause a lot of these Instagram photographs, you know, these people are airbrushed and, you know, professional, this or that. And, you know, it makes kids think that if they don't have those things or look that way, that, you know, they're never going to be good enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I used to make this like little comparison, right? There's two flowers in a field, right? So one flower says to the other one, like, which one of us is prettier? And it's like, well, what if we're both just pretty? Like, what if you're pretty the way you are and I'm pretty the way I am?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And it's kind of like they could be two different flowers. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But like we want to, like, I have to think I'm either as pretty as you or prettier. But the reality is, you know, one's a blue flower and one's a white flower and it doesn't matter. It's, you are who you are, right? Like just show your face to the sun and forget about it.
So accepting yourself for who you are and being comfortable in your own shoes and your own identity is, would you say, a big part of the book and the purpose of the whole process of helping students go through this?
Yes. Cause I, you know, teenagers are, they're so, I feel, you know, I mean, one time a colleague comes up to me in the hallway and she says, I'm looking for a kid in my class. Now he's not one of my students, so I don't know who he is. You know, he's really tall. Like he's got ears that stick out. He's a little awkward. And I was like, you've just described like 90% of the eighth grade boys, because the other 10% just haven't hit their growth spurt yet, but they're all like that, you know? And they just, it was just kind of one of those, like, it's got to be so hard you know, that to feel good about yourself when you're going through all, you know, your voice is cracking and like, you know, weird things are happening.
There's a lot of things we probably block out as adults. I know I certainly can. And some of what you're saying, you know, you may get a little flashback to, you know, middle school. So
yeah, that embarrassing moment.
Oh, good grief. So hard. So hard. Yeah. All right. Well, you have a lot of chapters. I think they're, you know, 30 chapters. And they're all short though, and they're organized in a workbook format. So you encourage students to do pre-writing before the chapters, during and after. Why? And you've kind of talked about this a little bit as far as the verbalization and metacognition, but why is it important for students to do writing around these topics and themes?
Okay. Well, first let me address, there's 30 chapters because as a teacher, I did this all year. So you don't start this week one. You got to establish, you know, some classroom atmosphere. And then a few weeks in, I would start this. And so the beginning of each week, a school year is about 36 weeks. And of course, the last few weeks are chaos, especially when you're in eighth grade and graduation and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, state testing, like there are so many weeks that you kind of lost them. But it was really geared to like, this will get you through an academic year. And it wasn't meant to do like one activity a day. It was like one a week and then, you know, thoughtfulness, right? And the second part of your question.
Just the importance of writing, getting the kids to write about this.
Sure. You know, they, you know, I watch them. They have phones. They can dictate a text message. They can just talk into their laptop and have it type for them. They can do all these things and they can do it at a speed where they don't even know what they're saying. But the questions in the book, they're so open-ended and individualistic, like that nobody had the same answer. You know, when I, like one of them was like, what's your biggest problem? What's the thing that's bothering you right now? Well, that's different for every kid sitting in my class right now. Maybe one of them is having a problem because their parents are going through a difficult time. Maybe one of them is having a problem because they're being bullied. Maybe one of them is having a problem because, you know, they're struggling academically, whatever, right? But you have to figure out the solutions and own your problem, right? Like that's kind of the goal. But if they don't, they don't sit and think about it, the writing slows it down.
Yes, right.
Because think about these, again, the Snapchat, the Instagram feed, their total lack of attention span is because everything's coming so fast. They don't have to focus. They don't have the ability to focus on things because they don't have to, because in another 2 seconds, another thing is going to come down that social media feed or across that screen or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, I did this like there was, you know, your phones were away. There's never a laptop. Sure. Nothing else was in front of you. Your desk was cleared. You had to be doing this, and I'd say to them, clear your space, you know, get rid of your visual distractions. I just want you to think of this piece of paper and whatever you're writing with right now. And it slowed them down. And I tell you what, it could be like the day before spring break, right? And you know how the energy in a room, it's hard to, you know, kind of keep a lid on that sometimes, but you could just watch the energy come down, and they were so calm. They were thoughtful. It was all of a sudden, you know, when I would speak to them, nobody would have to have me repeat it because the fact that they took that time, they slowed down, their brain slowed down. They were listening to their inner voice, which made it more possible for them to focus on the outer voice. Okay, now somebody is asking me to do something and the mind is not racing and now I can attend to that and I can do it. Which is amazing. It was really just amazing.
And it sounds like it's key too, because without that kind of a process, you're not going to do the deep kind of thinking and the metacognition and this grappling that is essential to the whole process.
That's absolutely right. And I think they don't have time, or I shouldn't say that. Everybody has the same amount of time, right? But they are not
making time. They may not be making the time.
They're not given the time either. And they have, you know, right. A lot of households are very afraid. If my kid doesn't have scheduled activities all the time, he or she is going to be left to their own devices. And oh no, you know, like it jumps from if they have free time, like they're going to be heroin addicts. Like I don't, you know, like there's a million little things between there, but if I don't fill their day, I'm afraid of what they'll fill their time with.
Oh, and I will do an extended answer on this because this is your interview, but like our youngest now is 11th grade junior, and just the quantity of homework that we ask her to do at our school, it just like, we would never ask adults in our society. I mean, as teachers, we do lots of work, but yes. I want that to get better for maybe my grandchildren, because it is not reasonable, and it does probably sit mostly with parents and this fear and this satisfaction that parents have when their kids have so much homework because they're like, oh, it's so good. They're so busy. And so anyway, I'm 100% with you on that.
Right. And you know what? And that's like, you know, I've got the next book is already in my mind here, but like the battle between busy and productive. Cause you know, those people who like to be busy and they're like the busy bee and they never sit still and they go from one thing to another, like almost mindlessly. Right. And they have this really long to-do list in random and unprioritized order, but it's going to keep me busy. Mm. And I'm like, but what did you like at the end? Right? What did you produce from that action?
Did you do deep work? Okay. I mean, there's a whole book about that, deep work.
Yeah.
And if you want to get to deep work, you can't just be, you know, a ping pong ball letting the social media and the agenda of the day, you know, hit you back and forth, you know, throughout your day. The other connection that I have to this is I've had a chance to do a little bit of work with some people involved in the National Writing Project. I've done this Institute for Digital Literacy the last couple of summers, and I'm thinking of one of the leaders in particular, and some of the focused writing that he had us do is similar to what you're talking about, because it was just quiet and everything else was put down, and it was this one challenging thought, you know, very, it was inquiry, but it was a very engaging prompt, but the way in which it was structured and the way in which distractions were put to the side. I mean, that right there is a huge pedagogical gem that probably, I'll just say as myself, teaching in my classroom, I am not doing that enough. And so I appreciate the reminder about that. And I think that wedding that to the kinds of questions and the kinds of thinking that you're wanting the students to do here is just super. It really is important. Cause I mean, what do all teachers feel? It's pressure that you have to go cover this, you know, material. So, you know, it's, you really have to give yourself permission to pause, but the thinking like you're describing cannot happen maybe unless we take that kind of a pause and that kind of an approach.
And, you know, that, I mean, that was my, you know, for any teachers who are listening to this, I assume a lot of your audience is going to be educators, but, that was, you know, part of my little experiment was like, this could fail because I'm not going to be getting through my curriculum if I take 20 minutes a week to go through this. And the reality was I would take those 15, 20 minutes. Maybe sometimes we'd get on a tangent conversation. Maybe it went a little, you know, a few minutes over that, but then the rest of my period, right? So it was 50 minute long periods. So the rest of the time, they were so much more engaged. I got everything done and at a deeper level, which like it was kind of like I had stumbled across this like little magic box. And when I opened it, it was like, wow, not only can I take the time to do this, but then the time that came after it had so much more value. Mm-hmm. And I'd hear teachers say to me things like, you know, this kid is really like challenging. This kid, you know, I just can't get him to stop. I can't get her to pay attention, you know, and I would say, I don't have that problem with them. Like they're fine for me. And because I set the stage for it.
Right. Yep.
And they knew that I was being genuine. Like I was standing up there talking about things that I believed in and practiced myself. I wasn't, you know, I didn't get it from somewhere else. I was like, okay, yes, I do read books and I do read these kinds of things, but then I apply them to my life and I took, you know, those experiences of my own and said, how does this translate when you're 13? Right. And it made such an impact on them. It was really something.
Well, speaking of ages, you've talked about eighth graders and your focus there. What would you say is the ideal range of ages for students that this is best for? And you've already talked about this a little bit, but as far as teachers and parents, it sounds like facilitating the process of helping them get, you know, go through these different questions. But can you speak to both the age range that you think is ideal and then how it might look different teacher versus parent for using this with your kids?
Sure. Ideally, I think ages 13 through about 18, right? That's who I wrote it for. And that was my focus as I wrote it. Now, I've gotten reviews on Amazon. I read the reviews and people are like, I gave this to my 21-year-old son and he loved it, right? And you're like, huh, didn't see that coming. Then I had a young adult. I was gallery sitting. I mentioned I was an artist, right? So I'm gallery sitting and this young woman comes in and pretty much people are now just coming out to see something other than the four walls of their house. So, you know, I strike up a conversation and are you local and blah, blah, blah. And she picks up the book and I said, oh yeah, you know, I wrote that book. She says, this is just the kind of stuff that even people my age want to read. Now she was clearly at least in college, if not maybe just out of college. So early 20s. And I think, you know, like I said, I've gotten feedback. They're like, I know some adults who could use these lessons, right?
Yeah.
But the real goal here is the younger you can get this into them, right? Because you ask a 5-year-old, what do you want? They know exactly what they want, right? And then somehow, right? Like they're like, yeah, I want that, right? And they know why they want it too, right? Because it's going to be so much fun if I have it, or if it's going to be so delicious if I have this, right? They know. But then they get to 13 and they're like, I'm not sure what I want because I'm not sure what's cool because now I'm going to be judged by a whole lot of different.
Right. The social aspects of life have become way more complicated.
It's a lot of pressure.
What aspect of the book do you think, let's just say, you know, middle schoolers, teens, the kids that are the most target audience for this are going to find the most challenging and difficult. Is there a particular aspect of it or would the process kind of be equally challenging as far as just, you know, finding the time to quiet your mind and to focus and to step through it, having that discipline? Yeah.
So I think the thing about that is, being given the time to focus is super important. They probably don't get a lot of that at home. They've got the distraction of siblings, chores, you know, other responsibilities and, you know, video games and all the other entertainment and distractions. So that's one thing. But I have to tell you that I would do these lessons and you question yourself, no matter, you know, we're human, right? So I'd say, geez, I don't know. They didn't get a big response from last week. I wonder if these kids were really like connecting to that, right? And so then the kid who wouldn't say two words in your class walks in, looks at the board, says, oh, it's Mindful Monday. I love this, right? So I never knew which lesson was going to connect with which kid. And they'd stop and they'd linger. Their friends would leave and they would be like dropping their book. Oh, I'll be with you in a minute. And they would linger after class and tell me stuff, you know, like, oh, you know, I did a lesson one in, of there, the story of the two monks about holding grudges. And they'd be like, you know, my dad hasn't talked to his brother in 10 years. Mm. And, you know, and like I, you know, they'd boil down that conversation. I'd be like, yeah. And that, you know, and that would bother them. And I'd say, well, you realize it's because in the same situation, your father would have done something different than what his brother did. Right. Yeah. And, you know, she went home and had that conversation with her dad. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow. Yeah. Right.
That's right.
But nobody else stopped after and talked to me that week about grudges. But the next week, I'd have a completely different topic.
Right. Well, you just never know what somebody's path is, where they are, and you know what battles they're fighting, and what kind of hole they find themselves in. So,
and that was why, you know, like, because some of the topics are, you know, they're very closely related, but they come sort of from a different angle, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's just the right angle that gets them to think about, you know,
where they are.
Yeah, where am I? Where do I want to go? And what can I control to get myself through this?
Right.
A lot of it was, I get it, you're 14. There's a lot of things you can't choose right now, but you know, there are some things you can. How do you make life better? And I was always surprised, at what they shared because, you know, they put on the big front, right? And you thought everything was fine, or at least, you know, to the casual observer, right? And then they would share with you this thing. And it was nice because they would unload it. And I had that trust because I was like, I'm being honest with you. This is why I feel this is important. And then they could share something with me and they knew that was it. It was in the vault. Like it wasn't going anywhere. So right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I might know part of what you'll say here, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If you could go back in your own life as both a parent and a teacher, what advice would you give yourself with regard to what you know now about this kind of a process, the questions and not even just the questions, but like you said, the time and the permission and the encouragement and the safe environment. What kind of advice would you give your younger self?
I think I would have told myself, quit worrying about getting through the curriculum. Because in the end, you know, I've asked educators, like as a group, what do you want for them? Right? You want them to have a successful life. You want them to be happy. You want them to be healthy. You want all these things, right? Do you really, like, is your goal that they can graph a quadratic equation? I don't even know if that's a thing. I didn't teach math, but like,
I think we still do it. Yeah, we still do that.
Yeah. Like, I'm just like, I'm going to put two together. Quickly. I don't even know. Right. But like, are you super concerned about, you know, if they use dangling participles? Like, is that your focus for their life? Like, it's not. Like, you want them to be good human beings, right? Who are productive and do all these things. And I was so, I always put that pressure on myself to, well, the supervisor wants this, so I got to make sure and check that box so that he has what he needs. And the administrator wants this, so I got to make sure and check that box so that, right? And sometimes I was so caught up in that, sort of tedious tasks that didn't really support the education of the kids. Like, I get it. You need the code of the standard that goes with this lesson. So I'd be looking those up and like typing those in. I'd be doing that kind of stuff, putting pressure on myself. In the meantime, if I had said to myself, okay, that's a thing that I have to do, but first, you know, let me look at if I kept my sights on the big picture instead of the little tasks.
The macro instead of just the micro.
Yeah.
The big picture. There's a really amazing video that NASA released in January with interviews of astronauts about what it's like to look at the planet, especially on a spacewalk. Cause when you're inside the station, you know, you've got that glass, but when they have their helmet, which is like wide view. I mean, it's incredible because they can't really even put it into words, but that's what it reminds me of, you know, because you have this incredible perspective that you can have. It's a really big perspective. And I think that is absolutely true for teachers. It's so easy for us to forget that and to just get caught up in some minutia, which has importance, but it is not, you know, the critical thing that we're all wanting.
In the big picture though, like some of that minutia is just, it keeps me busy, but it doesn't it's not really like productive to the outcome of the education. Like I know where I'm going. I know my content, right? Yeah. So I don't need a code to tell me that it's important that they understand about gravity.
That's right. Well, you've answered this question a little already. The question is, how do you think it's different today in 2021 for teens seeking personal success in life? We've talked a little bit about, you know, all the comparisons, how the pool is bigger, and then there's just more inputs with, you know, smartphones and social media. Do you think there are other differences in terms of how they're forming their identities and finding success and navigating everything that they do have to navigate today beyond what we've already kind of touched on?
I think they have access to more things that can do the emotional damage and the physical damage than they did. You know, when I was a kid, there was that kid who would smoke cigarettes. Okay. But like on the whole, I don't think as many kids, or at least I didn't know that many who were doing that. Right. But now it's like you could be vaping, you could be, you know, taking all kinds of things that I just don't, maybe they were accessible, but kids weren't really doing it in the 80s.
Access to potentially harmful materials and ideas is quite different.
And the idea, you know, people are really putting out a lot of, you know, volatile stuff.
Oh yeah, you know, emotional stuff. We did a unit on conspiracy theory, and one of the things, this is called a SIFT for, you know, acrostic, but like stop, but especially if it's emotional, especially if it grabs you, and recognizing how many things are intentionally trying to manipulate us. And a lot of those are with emotions and, you know, things that are strong. I mean, it's not a weak little reaction. It's sometimes getting a really strong one. There's more of that, even in advertising, but beyond just advertising.
I was just going to say, like, listen, you know, without watching a screen, listen to a commercial, right? Listen to the choice of words, what you deserve, what you're entitled to, what, you know, all of these things. And now it's kind of like, well, in 2021, I should have more. Right. I should have bigger. I should have better because I'm entitled to it because, you know, and I think that's, you know, there's this, false sense, right? That we should have all of the things, and all of those material things that we have are somehow linked to happiness, which we all know, you know, as adults, we know this isn't true.
We do, but we still live in a culture that says that's true, and it is hard to live in a culture that's reflecting messages at you all the time and not, you know, buy in to a big degree with it, so.
Oh yeah, cause you're like, oh wait, ooh, that is cute. Maybe I do want that, you know, and then, you know, but I don't know if COVID, I honestly think that's an outcome of this whole COVID stay home thing that maybe there's less of that. I don't know. You know, like, Amazon, you know, vehicles are everywhere all the time, all hours, you know, 7 days a week.
That's right.
But I think more focus has been on, okay, we need these things, like, right? And I don't know if there's, I don't know if it's helped the impact. I know the isolation is no good.
Right.
You know, the fact that they can't connect with their peers the way they like to. I mean, that's taken a huge emotional toll on them.
Probably,
but I don't,
social
I don't
media
know
has probably helped some.
It's, I mean, material stuff, maybe less. I don't know.
Well, okay. So let's talk about digital diets. Your first chapter, you know, as far as your dirty mind reminds us that we are the thoughts that we have, the ideas that we bring in. We need to be really thoughtful and intentional about that. So what kind of advice do you give with respect to digital diet beyond the teacher advice you already have to say, when you're doing this, clear everything out, you know, there's no distractions. This really needs to be a focus time when kids can have permission to do that sort of deep work and that deep thinking.
Right. So your question is, what am I telling them about
their digital diet? I think of, I mean, it kind of ties to what you've already said, and some of what I think about that is, you know, intentionality, you know, but what, in terms of like screen time or just with respect to social media, is there a message in this for kids that you want them to get to when it comes to how they think about consuming information and ideas, spending time in front of their screens, you know, marinating in social media? What kind of advice and nudges are you trying to give them with respect to all that?
Okay. Well, I was, you know, very open and honest with my students because that's who I am, right? So, you know, I would say to them, look, like I'm a tree hugging dirt worshiper. Like I am such the pacifist, right? However, I love my son. He is a Marine, right? So like because of him, we all sleep better at night. And I get that there's a place for that. Right. So they knew that like I also had conflict in my, you know, in my day to day, but I also made a pact with myself. I don't even know how many years it's been now, but one day, like I looked at what is wrong with America? You know, I had one of those like rant moments and I'm like, people are so desensitized to the violence and all these terrible things that are happening. And I made a resolution to myself. I said, no more. I will not watch any TV or movies or, you know, listen to songs that have violence. And I will not use that as my entertainment. Right. So that pares down what you're going to watch on TV. If nothing that you watch has violence in it. Right. So no police shows. Right. No. You know, they had all these crazy adventure, but you know, like 24 and like, you know, all these other shows. Well,
and the prevalence of, you know, of lots of shooting games. I mean, it's just, it's amazing that so many kids are spending so many hours hunting humans virtually, you know,
my phrases in school was, you can't use the F word in my class. And they'd look at me, I go, I don't want to hear about Fortnite. I just don't want to hear it. Yeah. And they were like, oh, okay. And I was like, there it is. Like, I don't like, and then I would be like, you are learning like what good, we're learning problem solving. Really? Can you think of another way?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, they've learned to justify things. I've heard the kids come up with all kinds of things for why, you know.
That's part of one of my favorite chapters in the book. You know, it's like you have 30 children, you can't pick a favorite, but chapter 16 is truly like one of my favorite chapters. And it's like the food pyramid, you know, like, but I break it down into four, like it tastes good, but it's healthy for you, right? It's good for you. It tastes bad, but it's healthy for you. So that's like the asparagus and Brussels sprouts that kids don't want to eat, right? Then it tastes good and it's bad for you. So that's like the Doritos and the Coca-Cola and stuff. And then there's the taste bad for you, right? So they get it when you talk about food, right? They know. And then I go like, let's examine behavior, right? Yeah. And I had these giant whiteboards that I would let kids like do diagrams, and when we would brainstorm, like their groups would write on these whiteboards, and I just put the four things up, like feels good for you, feels bad, good for you, feels bad, good for you, you know, like, and I had the same four categories as food, and they would start writing things. And like, I was like, I'm not generating these answers. What are you guys going to write? And like, feels bad for you. They were like admitting cheating, lying to your parents. Like they were full on, you know, open. Cause I was like, this is anonymous. Like I'm going to be over here. You guys are going to write on the boards. Nobody's putting their name next to anything. Let's just talk about these. And like, we'd start generating these discussions. And, you know, I had these instances where I'd be like, okay. And you know, we're going to be writing lab reports or, you know, whatever the assignment was. And I'd get a groan and I'd be like, feels bad. Good for you. You know, and that was it. They would quit complaining because they're like, you're right. I just am being lazy and I just don't want to do this,
but
it will make me smarter. Well, and then I had a kid who was like phenom athlete, like truly, truly athletically gifted. Right. And So he was like busting another kid about whatever in gym class, or like your team is going to go down at the football game. I can't even remember what it was, right? And I just looked at him and I was like, feels good, bad for you. And I walked away. I didn't have to intervene. I didn't have to say anything to anybody. He like apologized to the other kid of his own volition. Like I did not have to go any further than that. But he was like, he suddenly was like, yeah, maybe trash talking is not the way to go. Like, and I was like, yeah, a little humility about being athletically gifted goes a long way. But when you make other people feel bad that they don't have the same gifts as you, like that's, is that what you really want? And, you know, well, just thinking about it, you know, made a difference.
And you're giving them a framework of making meaning with those behaviors, with those ideas, and you're labeling it, you're giving it names, and then you're helping them be able to differentiate and categorize and prioritize. So I think that really is powerful because you're helping them take their own behavior and their own experiences in their life. But it's like new lenses. I mean, we talk about this with media literacy or with all kinds of things, but like once you've learned to look for transitions in a movie or look for the product placement or whatever, I mean, you really can't not see it because now you've learned to see it. So that's what that sounds like to me, is you're giving them a framework for looking at their own behavior as well as the behavior and words of their peers, and then thinking, you know, more deeply and intentionally about those. Good.
And the other nice thing that it did was, you know, you go through these lessons and, we created like our own language that somebody else might not know what that phrase meant. Like if they were not my student, they weren't in my class, or, you know, sometimes you have the administrator who comes in and observes you, and like you use this phrase and the kid would like immediately like self-correct. Right. They would do what they knew they should have been doing, but we had this separate language.
Yeah.
And they understood it. I understood it. And we both had ownership of it because we had this mutual experience.
Yeah. Tacit and cultural signals that you're able to give to each other.
Yeah.
All right. So, I want to ask you a question about impact. What would you like the impact of your book to be, both on teenagers and then on parents of teenagers?
Okay. So I know how much impact this had on just the few hundred kids that I have had, in my own classes, right? And it was just so hugely helpful. My goal, my vision, and I'm reaching out to school districts about this, is to get this in schools, to help them just be better. Not because the rules say so, and by their own definition, right? Be better at what they want to be better at, but just be more thoughtful, less attached to the outward influence and more connected to their inner voice, because they have it, right? And so, I mean, that for me is the goal. I want to impact these teenagers in a world where the impacts they're getting right now are not interested in their health, their lifestyle, their future. They're, you know, and I've had those conversations with kids, like, okay, I said something about vaping and 10 kids turned and looked at you. So I'm having this conversation with you. I'm not turning you in. I'm not calling your parents. I'm saying the guy who drives a Porsche on the money that he makes by making vaping devices does not care 40 years from now how you die. Like, do you get that? And they were looking at me like, wow. And I'm like, no, I'm being real with you. Like, I don't have a consequence for you, but I'm telling you this is how it is, you know? And then you leave it there, mm-hmm. you know? And it gave me so many opportunities to have that impact. And I know there are teachers out there and there are parents out there who love these kids, right? And you want to see the best for them, and the teachable moments, they just come pouring out, because now you've got a shared language to have it over. You've opened the door to these deep topics, right? And I think for parents, it's hard to figure out what to talk to your teenager about. And it's maybe hard to come up with the angle to come from because, you know, you don't always want to hear what your parent has to say. And of course, when they're 13 and 14, parents are just like the dumbest people they've ever met because they don't know anything. And it gives you like sort of this platform to start conversations. So even if you're not like handing this book to your kid, you're reading it and you're saying, I never thought about it that way. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Or your kid has a problem and now suddenly you can have that conversation about like, well, let's think of our vertical solutions and think of our horizontal solutions and see which one would work, right? Because now you've got like this framework for two different kinds of problem solving. I don't tell kids what the solution to their problem is. I say, what's your biggest problem? And they all know what that is. They don't need any prompting here, right? They all have one that comes right to mind. And suddenly they look at it differently, like, oh, I can solve this, right? But I have to solve this. Mm-hmm. I have to do something about it. And I think that's the impact I want to have is to give parents the tools to have those conversations, give teachers the tools to start that conversation, because in the end, the education goes deeper. The relationships go deeper. I can count on maybe two fingers the times I had a disciplinary issue. When I did these lessons in my classroom, kids came in, they immediately felt the energy of the room was, no, we're like positive and respectful here. And, you know, if you're going through something, all you have to tell me is that you're going through something today. And I will be sensitive to that, right? Because now that's our relationship. And you don't have to try to hide it. You don't have to do anything, you know, you don't have to do anything to draw attention to yourself or to be disruptive because we're all going to just be respectful. And it was so impactful. Honestly, like I said, I never thought about writing a book. And then once this came along, I was like, I can't not do this.
Right. Yeah.
It was so helpful.
Well, and what I'm hearing you say is empowering, you know, you're empowering students.
Absolutely.
To be able to connect with their inner voice and to be able to recognize the capabilities that they have. And then similarly with parents as well, empowering them to have these tools and to have these conversations. Empowerment.
It was very empowering for the kids. They, they thanked, you know, when 14-year-old boys leave a note on your desk saying thank you for that.
Yeah.
I have a little file I've saved.
Uh-huh. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, this has been a great conversation. How can people get in touch with you? How can they learn more about the power of choice? Obviously they can Google that. They can get on Amazon. Your advocacy work that you're doing around this. How do you recommend people kind of go from here besides going out there and getting a copy of the book?
Well, as you said, it's available on Amazon. That's easy. If let's say you are an educator or you're a school district, or you're an organization that works with teens and you want bulk copies, you can contact me directly and it's not going to cost you the Amazon royalties to get that. And that's at right now, my website is currently under construction, so I can't even, give you the .com.
I'll update the show notes once it's updated or whatever.
Yeah.
I'll put it
definitely
in there.
Put that in your show notes as soon as I get that to you, which I will do. But they can email me at thepowerofchoiceforsuccess@gmail.com. I am currently partnered with Youth Corps, which is an organization that helps kids who have dropped out of high school. They want to come back. They want to get their GED. So now I'm part of their, like, let's build some better life habits and make better choices, because one bad decision shouldn't rule the rest of your life, right?
Yes.
But you also maybe need some skills. Maybe they haven't gotten enough, enough guidance to get them to a better point in their life. So I'm partnered with that organization. I'm reaching out to school districts. I would have made more phone calls today, but 5 inches of snow here in Jersey. So everybody's home.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share. And we definitely want to encourage everybody to check out The Power of Choice, A Teen's Guide to Finding Personal Success by Ruth Larson. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I so appreciate it.
Moving at the Speed of Creativity podcast are independently produced by Wesley Fryer and are licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Only license. Learn more at www.speedofcreativity.org.